The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome back. As we head into hour three, concluding our week, we usually conclude our weeks on Fridays with discussions with our favorite public intellectuals. Sometimes it's Pete Peterson, sometimes it's others. And today we are delighted and blessed to have Tevi Troy. Dr. Tevi Troy is a presidential and cultural historian, author of several books, most recently Fight House, Rivalries in the White House from Truman to Trump. Every book he's written, however, kind of touches on the issues I wanted to talk to him today, maybe starting with his very first book, which I believe came out of his dissertation on his book on public intellectuals. Tevi Troy, Dr. Troy, welcome back to the show.
Seth, thanks for having me. I'm really honored to sit in the Pete Peterson slot. I enjoy your end-of-the-week interview with him every week, and I'm glad to be here.
Oh, well, that's kind of you. He's on travel in Hawaii. He said he'll be back with us next week. And I told him, well, I'll be in Santa Barbara part of next week at the end of the week, so we'll have to put it off a little bit longer. And he said, Reagan territory, enjoy. And I sent him back a picture of Tom Selleck posing with Ronald Reagan and Nancy Reagan. And I said, well, you're in Magnum territory. I'm not sure which is better.
Well, if he's in Hawaii, then his gain is my gain in this case.
Uh-huh. It's all of our gain. We love you all. We love you both. Tevi, am I right, by the way? Was your dissertation on public intellectuals? The reason I asked.
Intellectuals in the American presidency. It was on intellectuals who worked in the White House.
Yeah.
People like Arthur Schlesinger, who worked for Kennedy, Pat Moynihan, worked for Nixon, Marty Anderson, worked for Reagan,
right,
and what those people did when they served in the White House.
All right. The reason I wanted to put that predicate out there is I spoke earlier in the week with Ryan Williams, the president of the Claremont Institute. I think you're familiar with that interview. And
I listened to it.
Yeah. Yeah, it was based on this big New York Times story about the Claremont Institute. And the reason I thought the New York Times story was important was because, A, it took a look at this very, I think, established conservative institute. The Claremont Institute did what I would call a pretty darn fair job of analyzing it, and a long job of it, an in-depth job of it. But also wanted to kind of get your take on the role that these places actually are for. The philosophers used to talk about praxis, P-R-A-X-I-S, taking ideas and putting them into action. These think tanks, whether it's Claremont, whether it's the congeries of think tanks on the East Coast, they're not just there for airy abstraction. So, Tevi, talk to us about the importance of think tanks, and let's work our way through to what makes them different and how we think of them and should think of them, especially in the era of this Republican Party and conservative movement, as putting their things into practice. So I guess I would start this way. Sorry for the long windup. Just wanted to introduce it to the audience. Start this way, maybe. Your view of the Claremont Institute's importance, or at least founding, and the New York Times expose of it, or in-depth analysis of it, and let's go from there. Why is Claremont different? Why does Claremont exist? And what did you think of the takeaway from the New York Times part of it?
Yeah, lots to go through there, Seth,
yeah,
and
yeah.
I'm happy to do it. There are 2,200 think tanks in the United States and about 400 in the D.C. area, that congeries of East Coasters that you're talking about.
Yeah.
And they have been incredibly important in the American political landscape, but even more so, I would say, in the conservative political landscape.
Yeah.
One of the reasons for that is because conservatives have been largely shut out from the university. So smart talent, people who would become professors in another fairer world in academia, they gravitated towards think tanks. And there was a big push in the 1960s. You know, we talk about wokeism and cancel culture on campus now. But in the 1960s, a lot of conservatives did not feel comfortable on campus. And so they gravitated towards these think tanks, many in Washington, but not all. And they started to generate ideas, and it was really about praxis, as you say. The intellectuals on campus are a little more abstract and weren't really focused on practical solutions. They were kind of dancing on the head of a pin. But the think tank intellectuals really sought solutions, answers, policy proposals. And Ronald Reagan had over 500 intellectuals, mostly think tank intellectuals, backing his campaign in 1980. Many of them went and joined the Reagan Revolution and made it the success that it was. So think tanks hugely important. Let's put in that the Claremont Institute was founded, I believe, in 1979.
Right.
And the animating intellectual force was your mentor, Harry Jaffa, who was a student of Leo Strauss. And he wrote this seminal book on Lincoln, the Lincoln-Douglas debates, and how they really related to the political philosophy debates going back to Plato.
Yeah.
And it's a brilliant book. It was his best book, very important work, and he really helped to make Lincoln the hero he is in the conservative movement, and also really focus interest on the Declaration of Independence and the rights that it enumerates therein. So Claremont was very important in that regard. It has made some noise in recent years because it was, I think it's fair to say, more pro-Trump than many of the other Washington think tanks. And that led to opportunities in the Trump administration. And indeed, I believe they got a National Medal of Honor or Presidential Medal of Honor during the Trump years. But it also led to critics. And I think some of the people at Claremont went overboard, particularly Mr. Eastman. I don't want to get too far into that. But it's clear there's some disagreement within the Claremont world. And Charles Kessler, who's a mentor of mine, and I was a Publius Fellow at Claremont, and Claremont had these fellowships that they've been using to educate the conservative movement for over 30 years. And so Charles Kessler, I think, is really trying to maintain a certain standard and a certain level at Claremont. And I think he's doing a good job, but there's clearly disagreements within the ranks there. And it's going to be very interesting to see how it plays out at Claremont.
I think that's all great, greatly analyzed. And one of the interesting things about it being founded in 79, Ryan and I were talking about this a little bit. Ryan Williams and I were talking a little bit about this, was that that was really the flowering of a lot of the 1970s saw the flowering and creation and growth of a lot of think tanks. That was kind of the think tank creation decade. Is that fair? Is that still true? Maybe more so for conservatives than non-conservative think tanks?
Yeah, that was the amendment I was going to make.
Yeah.
It's certainly true, and especially on the right. I mean, Theodore White, who was a famous journalist, and I would say of a liberal persuasion, but he talked about a core of intellectual outriders on the right and how these people really helped shape conservative thinking. And the conservatives became the thinking party in the 70s, and the liberals were kind of caught by surprise. Where are all these conservatives coming with all these ideas? And it was a combination of think tankers, but also had the neoconservatives who migrated from the left to the right, and they all had a social science training. You had the philosophers, and you and I talked about that very interesting article by that professor from Assumption College, and he talked about how the most interesting stuff being taking place in philosophy today, in political philosophy today, is really done by people who are effectively grandchildren of Leo Strauss, meaning they are the students of Harry Jaffa, and who is the expositor of West Coast Straussianism, and Alan Bloom, who is really the lead force in East Coast Straussianism. And those people combined are really at the center of many of the most interesting debates in political philosophy today.
One of the things that Jaffa contributed to the study of American politics by bringing Lincoln down from the heavens, so to speak, if I might, by making Lincoln relevant again, as you put it, which he did, there was no real serious study of Lincoln's political philosophy until Harry Jaffa. And it goes into this in the New York Times, and I've heard the story a million times, but it's eminently true. I heard it from Jaffa himself. He found in the Lincoln-Douglas debates the exact debate that Plato, you mentioned this, Plato has in the Republic between Socrates and Thrasymachus about what is justice, and that it's not just derived from positive law, majority sentiment, or as Thrasymachus says, the interest of the stronger, whoever's strongest. Lincoln's career.
Thrasymachus, you can be remembered as the guy who believed might makes right.
Exactly.
And that's
exactly.
Not the American way.
Exactly. And Lincoln himself very specifically said that that right is what should make might. And what's interesting about that is that you would think that this was an adopted, already accepted point of view in American political discussion, and it wasn't. There's this notion between the positive law and the natural right argument that more and more people have come to, which is to say, just because a majority votes for something doesn't make it right. We can apply that to any number of things. It's often applied to the abortion debate. But this was kind of at the heart, actually, of Clarence Thomas's nomination hearings. I don't know if you remember watching those. I remember a lot of people were scratching their heads on the Senate Judiciary Committee talking to him about his philosophy of jurisprudence. And they were saying, what's this natural right business, right? What's this Declaration of Independence concept you have of reading laws through the notions of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness? Let me take a quick commercial break. Let's pick up on that. And let's talk a little bit, too, about intellectuals and their presence in the White House and what the movement should be thinking about with regard to the they can use from these think tanks and what the think tanks, quite frankly, should be thinking about in helping today's conservative movement. I'm Seth Leibson. He's Tevi Troy. His most recent book, Fight House, Rivalries in the White House from Truman to Trump, a great and fun read. Be right back. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. Dr. Tevi Troy is our guest. He is a presidential and cultural historian, author of several books, most recently Fight House, Rivalries in the White House from Truman to Trump. Tevi, in talking about the think tanks, the conservative think tanks and the conservative movement, first a question about what you said with regard to the staffing of the think tanks. They became houses for a lot of academics, conservative academics. Conservatives with their terminal degrees, that is to say, I guess their PhDs. And we've talked about this a lot, but I've always had the thought that in a way we're in a vicious cycle where we talk about how conservative intellectuals are not welcome on the college campuses for tenure track positions. But on the other hand,
or any positions, let's be fair.
Okay, any positions, that's fair. But on the other hand, we don't even try much anymore. We just immediately stampede to the Claremonts and the Heritages and the Hudsons and the AEIs. And I'm wondering if we're doing that at a certain cost or if it's just really a rational decision, a rational choice, that there's a waste of time to even try and apply at Berkeley.
Yeah, it's a good question, and you mentioned Berkeley, and our friend John Yoo is there, and Pete Hayward is there, so sometimes you do get a rare conservative on campus, but it seems usually that it's someone that the university went out of its way to say, okay, hey, look, we have a conservative.
Right.
99 out of 100 professors are liberals, but quasi-Marxists, but we'll show that we have one conservative. So it's not really a fair playing field on these campuses. Obviously, our friend Robbie George is at Princeton, but he is such in the minority, and the students don't feel like they can speak freely. And look what happened to Josh Katz at Princeton. He had some questions about and objections to BLM and what they were trying to do on campus, and he was railroaded out of town.
Yep.
So the campus, while I would love to see the campuses be freer or fairer places, it just does not seem to be realistic right now. And I think there's even a difference between when you and I went to college and what's going on now.
Yeah.
In our day, we were in the minority, and we knew we were in the minority.
Yeah.
But we could have the argument.
We were in the 73rd.
It was or canceled you or destroyed you for having the argument. And I think we were made stronger and better for engaging in the fight and not having everybody echo our ideas like they do on the left. But the fact that we were able to hone our arguments against people who were pushing back, I think, made conservatives stronger. Now, you go to college campuses, and I have kids at college age right now. The watchword is don't say a word because your life will be destroyed. You won't have any friends. You'll be shunned, and you won't be able to get a job after. So it's just different. It's worse, and I would like to get back to an era. I don't expect parity between conservatives and liberals on campus anytime in my lifetime or in the future, but I would like to see a free speech environment reign again on campus.
Well, of course. And these students, these marvelous students who have been, you know, educated by PragerU or talk radio. I mean, there's a new generation of young conservative students going into the colleges. I know of several examples here in Phoenix, and they're getting their summer reading. And it's all, you know, the diversity, equality stuff, which is really, you know, the BLM stuff put into academic language. And, you know, I've counseled them, and maybe I'm wrong. I'd love your thought. I have debated this with people. I've counseled these students, you know, if you're going to go to that college, bite your tongue, get through it, get the credential, and then go change the world. You are not going to change the college with your pushback. You're going to be punished and penalized. Good advice or not really? I mean, you have children going to college. You're on their way.
My joke on this, Seth, is that when my kid went to college, I said to him, when you're on campus, I don't want you to be alone in a room with a girl, and I don't want you to talk politics with anyone. When I went to college, all I wanted to do was be alone in a room with a girl and talk politics. Not necessarily at the same time, but it's just very different today. And so I was sorry to give him that advice, but I think it's the right advice.
Yeah, no, it's redolent of your advice you once told me about how to think about the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. Everything that should be legal and fun, we're regulating. Okay. I take the point, though. So get through it. Get the credential. You are not going to change these hardened institutions. The prayer is that they don't change you. And there's a lot of ways not to. I mean, you can have clubs. You can get the reinforcements from, you know, the think tanks and the think tank works. But that's really where I wanted to drive this next, Tevi, is what relevance do the think tanks have? Yes, they staff administrations. I was quoting Jean Kirkpatrick's essay yesterday on dictatorships and double standards. She'd have been an example of an academic that went into the Reagan administration and, what would you say, scripted the foreign policy of the Reagan administration.
Yes, but because she wrote something in commentary
right.
that President Reagan read,
right.
not because she was writing in an obscure
right.
academic journal
Good
that
point.
Nobody cared about.
Great point. And on that point, it raises the question, are we still able to do that? Are we still seeing academics from their perches writing in popular journals that can move politics, can change the way we think about things, that can help the conservative movement on the ground in political elections or in the governing once they win?
Yeah, let me make 2 points quickly. First of all, on the campuses, I agree that once you're there, get your credential, don't get in trouble. But I am starting to question the value of the credential at these elite
Me
woke
too.
Universities,
yeah.
and I am rethinking
yeah.
how you go about this. So that may be a conversation for a separate day, but I don't want to just say...
Let's return to it on this day. I'll come back to it in a minute. It's a big thought. Keep going, though. Yeah.
But the second thing, look, I wrote this book on intellectuals in the American presidency. It was my first book, and I saw a through line between the intellectuals who served Kennedy, even though they were on the left, and then going all the way through the Reagan era, and even in the Bush days and a little bit in Clinton, you had somebody who was supposed to be the idea man who brought in thoughts and thinkers to the president and then also helped explicate the president's ideas outward. And I would say in the recent administrations, I would include Obama and Trump and Biden, you don't really have a White House intellectual
right.
serving those administrations. And I think perhaps we have lost something because it's not clear how these ideas are getting to the White House. I mean, it seems like Slack channels and Twitter are driving the conversation more than thoughtful policy ideas. So I would like to see us get back to that. One other thing I would say is that it's not just that think tanks staff administrations, but they can also set an agenda for administrations. Famously, the Mandate for Leadership book that was written by Heritage and that was largely adopted by the Reagan administration, there's a great line in there that 2/3 of the proposals and mandates for leadership were used by Reagan or implemented by Reagan, and William F. Buckley, whom we both admire, quipped, and that's why the Reagan administration was 2/3 successful.
That's great. Someone once proposed to Richard Nixon when he was the president to bring in Bill Buckley as a communications advisor, and Nixon said no. Buckley's great, but he's a painter. I need someone who can connect dots and draw by numbers. let me pick up on that point about the value of that credential when we come back. That's no doubt going to be a big part of our debate nationally. Books are written about it. Bill Bennett wrote a book about it. Others have. I think Charlie Kirk has a new book out on this concept. Let's you and I toss that around when we come right back. Is college worth it is the question. I'm Seth Leibson. He's Tevi Choi. Between us, we've had a lot of college. How many degrees between us? I think 6 or 7. Anyway, we'll be right back. Portions of the show are brought to you by the good people at Balance of Nature. They are good people. They make a great product. I take it every single day. Pure, potent plant power. 100% natural. One daily dose gives you a blend of 16 whole fruits and 15 whole vegetables. All the good and potent stuff. And boost your immunity, your health, your energy. I think it's the best product I've ever taken. You can take it to a balanceofnature.com. Make sure to use discount code BALANCE. Dr. Tevi Choi is our guest, author of several books, including most recently Fight House, Rivalries in the White House, from Truman to Trump. Tevi, I assume you're always working on another book. Is it too soon to say what it's about, or should we leave that for another day?
Just quickly, I am working on a book based on a series of conferences I was doing on presidency in the 21st century and how it has changed in this century, and hopefully that will be out sometime late 22 or early 23.
Fantastic, fantastic. By the way, many of your books have influenced administrations, in particular your book on crisis management in the White House, Shall We Wake the President? Two Centuries of Disaster Management from the Oval Office. So you're a good example of how this praxis can work, where a public intellectual does write something that then an administration or a department can make use of. But on this really kind of tender issue, is college worth it? A lot of us used to say, look, credential up as far as you can. But a lot of us are rethinking that now, aren't we?
Yeah, the colleges may not be teaching useful information.
Yeah.
I'm not saying no college teaches useful information and no majors are useful, but to the degree that your kid is going to go and learn woke studies, that is not going to help them in the workforce. That actually may alienate your kid from you. So it's something to be really careful about. Now, I'm all for certain specific professional degrees. I'm for liberal arts education. But you've got to be careful about which college you send your kids to and what they learn there. I happen to be a big fan of Hillsdale College. The kids I meet from there are super smart. I just had coffee with a friend from Hillsdale College this week. He's probably 30 years old, and I had to use the restroom. And when I returned, he wasn't scrolling through his phone. He was reading a book of philosophy.
Yeah.
Now, that's the kind of thing we want to inculcate.
Yeah. No, absolutely right. I mean, there's a question that one has to ask to a parent as to why they would want to spend $80,000 a year for their child to unlearn everything the parent taught them about right and wrong, if they have.
Yeah, actually, on that point,
yeah.
I have a line, which is I say, I don't want to spend $80,000 a year to have my kid learn to hate Western civilization, America, and me.
Exactly right. That's exactly right. And more parents, I think, are coming to that conclusion. And you look back and think about it and just step back and think about $80,000 a year. That's probably a short number. That's probably a little bit smaller than what some of these colleges end up accounting for when you add in all the other ancillary things. But it's an amazing amount of money to spend to hate your country, your culture, and your civilization. And your parents.
And your parents.
Yeah, yeah. And your religion, right? I mean, that's another big hit at the universities. There is probably no set of institutions in this country that are more antithetical towards religious belief and practice than the university.
I have a great story on this.
Yeah.
So we're both friends with John DiIulio,
yep.
Who's a great Catholic professor at Penn. And my son is at Penn, and I noticed that Professor DiIulio, is on the board of the kosher dining hall at Penn. And I said, John, you are Catholic. Why are you on the board of this organization? And he said, Tevi, the only other kids on this campus, the Orthodox Jews are the only other kids on this campus who believe in God.
He also probably knows more about the laws of kashrut than most of right. The Jewish people on the campus there, quite honestly.
He does, but I admire him. I mean, there's a kind of small cadre of people who
Absolutely.
Are believers and
Absolutely.
Tend to be also patriotic, and they believe in Western civilization, and they congregate at the kosher dining hall, and he likes that.
Absolutely right. Absolutely right. Well, I continue to advise people to look at Hillsdale, or there are a few other colleges like that, not a ton, but a few, Patrick Henry. It's a different kind of experience. But that's what I advise. Mostly, I think I'd be in the camp of not wanting to send my kid to a college these days. I see what they do. I see what these it's 4 years where you have experts telling your child that your parents were wrong. Your parents were dumb. Your country is wrong. Your culture is oppressive. I think about it this way. Let me go to break and we'll pick up when we come back on the other side of break with this thought. I think about it this way. You know, for way too long, kids would come home from spring break, fall break, winter break, whatever, with these ideas to their parents that they learned in college, you know, quoting some French philosopher no one's ever heard of or some piece of literature that no one ever heard of justifying, you know, violence, revolution, Marxism. And the parents we would all say, oh, they'll get over it. They'll graduate into the real world. They'll get a paycheck. They'll see taxes being taken out. They'll start to normalize and become much more conventional. Well, we were wrong. We were wrong. After 40 years, the Ivory Tower had a lab leak that has infected our brains much more toxically, I think, than the lab leak that came out of Wuhan. We'll let Tevi address that when we come back. I'm Seth Leibson. He's Tevi Choi. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. If you're interested in a remarkably unique investment opportunity, check out my friends at YRefi. What they are offering up is a fixed no-load interest rate up to 10.25% for investors, all in a collateralized and secured portfolio. YRefi, it's a due diligence-approved firm run by really good people who do really well by doing good for others, and you can too. Check them out at investyrefi.com, the word invest, the letter Y, R-E-F-Y.com, or give them a call at 855-316-3087. Tevi, something did change with academia in a sense, as I was talking about it when I went to break. We did used to say these things about the left-wing ideas and notions kids came home with from college. We used to say they'll grow out of it. And we used to say they'll normalize once they get their first paycheck. And I think at the end of the day, the universities hardened, and we became increasingly mistaken on that point. I mean, if you want to look at the censorship ethos in social media and at these companies that attract all these college graduates, that's the 20, 30, and 40-somethings who learned that at these colleges. They're the ones who have no problem with censorship, for example.
Yeah, I think you're right to focus on censorship, because what happened was the colleges started this idea of, instead of being pro-free speech, they were pro-safety. And if you heard an idea that was disturbing to you, that you didn't like, that didn't comport with your liberal ideology, that threatened your safety. Now, it's a nonsensical notion, but that is what they started to believe on college campuses. So if it threatens your safety to hear an idea that is contrary to the received wisdom of the left in college, then it is also, by logical extension, problematic to hear that idea when you're out in the real world. And so these kids would go to companies and they would ask the human resources department to protect themselves from hearing ideas that they didn't like. And the human resources departments went along with it. And I think that's really where it started to infect more than just the universities, but the workplace. And you add to that Slack channels and Twitter, and everybody has a voice and they're expressing their voice and saying, this is disturbing to me. I don't like hearing about capitalism. I don't like hearing America is good. And then all of a sudden, the enforcers within the company say, well, we don't want to disturb any of our young workers. We want to be able to recruit workers. I'm not sure how good workers they are, but still that's what they're trying to recruit. And that is how it started to infect beyond just the colleges. And I think we were all better off when both left and right agreed on the value of free speech. And that, as you know, it's embedded in our Bill of Rights, in our Constitution. It is part of the lifeblood of America. And it is being taken away from us, and I think we really need to stand and fight and maintain this idea of free speech, because without it, we live in a tyranny. If you don't have free speech, you cannot have a functioning democratic republic.
I always thought it would be interesting effort to try and pass a law. You may be you remember a congressman from your home state, Gerald Solomon, many years ago?
Sure.
He had something put into the Defense Department authorization bill called the Solomon Amendment, which made it made the option for the Department of Defense to withhold monies to colleges that wouldn't allow ROTC recruitment. It's been rarely exercised, if at all, mostly in the breach. But I always thought one could add to that. You know, these universities get a lot of federal money, a lot, not Hillsdale, but most of them do. And it seemed to me that you could simply try and pass a law to entrench First Amendment to the universities, First Amendment principles to the universities as a condition for their federal aid. It just seems to me an idea worth exploring. I'm just putting it out there, not necessarily asking you to analyze it on the spot.
Let me just say that, unfortunately, the whole idea of federal money creating a handcuff for the universities is actually going in the other direction.
Yeah.
And the federal money has led universities to adopt all kinds of leftist positions, and that's one of the reasons why Hillsdale does not take federal money,
right?
Because they don't want to be beholden to the whims of the federal government.
That's exactly right. It's gone in the other direction. So I'm hoping, you know, if God please, the Republicans do win in November, which I'm hoping they will, and it's looking like they can, that this maybe we can get some support for turning this back. By the way, it's not just the colleges and universities, right? We are now seeing this administration use things like Title IX to withhold monies. They're threatening to withhold monies from public elementary schools, right, that don't accept the entire warp and woof of the transgender agenda and movement. So, I mean, it's not just colleges and universities anymore, Tev.
Yeah, and so it goes. I read this article in National Review about a year or two ago about all of the influences that your child has to overcome to be conservative. So you have to overcome what you're hearing in kindergarten, what they're writing in a children's book, and what you're seeing in the popular culture, and what you read and see in the news, and then what you get in college, and then what you get in graduate school, and then what you get in the HR department at your company. And all of those forces are, what are they arrayed against? Maybe your church, if you go. Maybe your parents, if you're in a family where the parents are actually willing to argue or make the case for these things. So the tide is against you if you want to raise your child conservative. And it really takes a lot more work to raise a conservative child than it does to raise a liberal child, which is just go along with the flow of what's going out there in the culture.
Just another example of what we often say, which is, and not including that until today, and you said it, which is it's harder to be a conservative than a liberal. It takes more work. It just, you know, you have to unwind every story now. You can't, right? It takes a lot to unwind conventional wisdom as preached from CNN or the New York Times these days. It's harder to be a conservative. You have to do
That's
more.
That's what it is rewarding. So let's not forget that.
Say that again.
It is rewarding.
Oh, yes, absolutely. As Thomas Paine said, the greater the struggle, the greater the reward. Yes, absolutely right.
Or Warren Buffett, who said, if every hole were a hole-in-one, you wouldn't play golf.
That's right. That's right. I'm almost tempted to end on that note, except for one thing I needed to run by you. And it's from a conversation. Speaking of academics, I don't know if you know him. I recently discovered an emeritus professor of poli-sci at Chicago, University of Chicago, Charles Lipson, L-I-P-S-O-N. I don't know if you've done work with him or not. But
I don't work with him, but I know you interviewed him on the show.
Yeah, we were talking yesterday. He was making a point. I wanted to tie two things together. You were talking about public intellectuals in White Houses. You said even Bill Clinton had one. Yes, he did. I think it was Bill Galston, wasn't it?
Yes, Bill Galston did work for him.
William Galston. And so Charles Lipson was making the point about how newspapers are dying, but there's a few that still have vibrant op-ed pages. The Wall Street Journal always cited as one of the first. And I was going to make a point you had made to me, but I clumsily forgot to do so, and I wondered if you would make the point again, if you can recall it. It had to do, isn't it interesting that the most respected liberal columnists in America can only find their works done at a conservative journal like the Wall Street Journal op-ed page? Something along those lines, right?
Yeah, I mean, Bill Galston is, for my money, one of the smartest liberals out there.
Or Walter Russell Mead might be another, maybe, yeah.
I'm not sure I'd call him a liberal, but Galston is a liberal. He's worked in the Clinton administration. You know, he's devoted his life to running Democratic causes. But he writes a thoughtful column in the Wall Street Journal, much more thoughtful, in my opinion, than the liberals you see in the New York Times op-ed page. And I think it's recognizing that he's going to have to justify his argument to people who may not agree with him that makes his writing stronger. And I think we should all think about how we can test ourselves and test our premises. And that's the point I was making earlier about being on college campus as a conservative. It actually honed your skill as someone who can make arguments and your rhetorical skill. And so I think that Galston is better because he appears in a conservative outlet.
And as far as I know, there are no calls to the editorial board of the Wall Street Journal to fire Bill Galston because he's a liberal. I think that's interesting, too.
Yeah, and I think they make no bones about it. We have a liberal on staff. Yep. He's a thoughtful liberal, and we're happy to have him.
Yep, we are not the censors in this country. Tevi, you are wonderful. Thank you for spending some of your Friday evening with us, or your Friday almost evening with us. Tevi Troy, you can check out his books. Fight House is a great, great read because it's about modern history, rivalries in the White House from Truman to Trump. It's a lot of fun. You learn a lot, and you have a good time doing so, which is really the definition of my friendship with Tevi. I learn a lot and have a good time doing so. Tevi, thank you.
Thank you, Seth, and a great weekend to all your listeners.
You got it. We'll talk soon. I'm Seth Leibson. I'll be right back. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. Great way to end the show with the little Joe Walsh there. For those of you listening on podcast, that's a live version of Joe Walsh's Life's Been Good, which you can get online. We've talked a lot about Harry Jaffa this week. I'll just close the show. I think it's a good day to close the show with this line of his, which I've used with you before, and people ask me for it again and again. The salvation of the West must come, if it is to come, from the United States. The salvation of the United States, if it is to come, must come from the Republican Party. And the salvation of the Republican Party, if it is to come, must come from the conservative movement within it. And the salvation of the conservative movement, if it is to come, must come from the renewal and reaffirmation of the principles of the American founding embodied in the Declaration of Independence. As we here commemorate and celebrate having completed our primary elections and are going into the general, hopefully taking it to the left and the Democrats, good thing to keep in mind. Good thing to keep in mind, what are the basis of our conservative principles? And the basis of our conservative principles, yes, we learn a lot from the Europeans, and we learn a lot from the Greeks, of course, too. But start with American principles. Start with conserving America as our founders saw it and as the principles are embodied and defined in the Declaration of Independence. Not a bad grounding, that. It's how we got here in the first place. It's the only thing we can redound to if we want to keep it. Until Monday, God bless you all. Great week. Class dismissed.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.